The teaching of the Bible alone is that sinners are saved by grace alone, through faith or belief alone, in Christ alone, so that all the glory goes to God alone.
The law is given for the knowledge of sin. It is not given for the justification of the believer. And that is the legal use of the law. To try to use the law in a way of justifying oneself is an illegal use of the law.
Protestant orthodoxy taught that man was a sinner, depraved in all his parts and functions, and therefore desperately in need of divine grace.
You're listening to Trinity Foundation Radio. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Thank you for joining me for episode 28. Today, my guest is a returning guest, a name I'm sure you're all familiar with, Tim Kaufman. Tim, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Great to be back.
Outstanding. It's great to have you here. And Tim and I are going to be discussing his paper. It was published as a Trinity Review toward the end of 2023. The title of that paper, the Trinity Review, I should say, is Julius and the Roman Prerogative. So it's a very interesting paper, and I think you're going to get a lot out of this. Well, Tim, why don't you, to get started here, I thought, you know, I'd like to give the listeners kind of a 35,000-foot view of what we're going to be talking about. As you and I talked about in the pre-interview, some of it's a little bit technical, but let's kind of let them see the forest before we talk about any of the trees here. So the first thing I wanted to ask you about is this. You know, just to get us started, the title of your paper is called Julius and the Roman Prerogative, and that seems like a pretty good place to start. So who is the Julius you're talking about, and what is this Roman prerogative?
Well, since we're cruising at 35,000 feet, you are now free to roam about the history, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a look at history. What we're talking about is a time period when Constantine became emperor. He was emperor from 306 to 337 AD. Julius became bishop of Rome the same year that Constantine died, and he remained bishop of Rome through 352 AD. And so the context of what he said, that is the prerogative that he exerted, was in the case of the trial of Athanasius of Alexandria, and he had been deposed. And Eusebius of Nicomedia had pressured Athanasius of Alexandria to admit the Arians back into the church. Athanasius refused. And then in successive trials at Tyre and then at Antioch, he was ultimately deposed from his seat in Alexandria and replaced by someone named Gregory of Cappadocia. And so he appealed to Rome to be reinstated to his episcopal seat in Alexandria. And that's not all there is to the story, but that's enough to get us started. But when Julius was serving as the court of appeals, the court of appeals for Athanasius's appeal, he was facing uncooperative litigants, the Eusebians, and he wrote a letter to them and he rebuked them with a question that has long since been stretched way beyond what its context can possibly bear. He wrote, "Are you ignorant that the custom has been for word to be written first to us and then for a just decision to be passed from this place?" That was in his lengthy letter to the Eusebians when they were not cooperating in his process of discovery. So this Council of Rome was taking place to hear the appeal of Athanasius in 340 AD, and then it was followed on by another trial in Sardica in 343 AD. So in the middle of all this, from Tyre to Antioch, through Alexandria to Rome to Sardica, and ultimately to the emperor's court, we find Julius dealing with some uncooperative litigants, and he says, "Hey, you should be writing first to us and then for a just decision to be passed from this place." So he was exerting what I call the Roman prerogative. He was saying, "Hey, we're going to make the decision here." And he believed justifiably that the Eusebians were supposed to write to him first so he could make a ruling in the case of Eusebian party versus Athanasius. He was right. But he had that prerogative as an appellate judge, not as a chief justice. And there's a big difference between those two. He was a mid-level appellate judge. His ruling was going to be heard in a higher court, and then that court's ruling was going to be heard in a court even higher than that. So he's a mid-tier appellate judge trapped between Antioch and Tyre below him and Sardica and the emperor's court above him. So unfortunately, that nuanced distinction of a mid-level appellate judge dealing with uncooperative litigants, that nuanced distinction has been largely lost to history. And so in hindsight, people are looking at this, well, he must have been the chief justice of the church. So if you look up Julius of Rome on Wikipedia, you'll find a history in air quotes that just butchers the meaning of his sentence. And they summarize his episcopate by saying he is notable for asserting the authority of the Pope over the Arian Eastern bishops. That's not true. It's not true. It's absolutely false. The Catholic Encyclopedia does no better, summarizes Julius's letter to the Eusebians saying the Alexandrian church should have first written to the Pope, that is, the people who deposed Athanasius. And that's not what he was saying. That's most certainly not what Julius was saying. So examining what he actually wrote, that is, examining the Roman prerogative that he exhibited in its historical context, is precisely what we're going to, the paper was written to do. That was the primary objective of the paper, because that history has so long been overlooked and twisted to say something that doesn't say. So in our analysis, we discover the precise context that completely changes its meaning. And it changes the interpretation of Julius, supreme chief justice over the early church, into a frustrated mid-level appellate judge dealing with uncooperative litigants. That's a big difference.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary difference. I mean, it's almost night and day. It's and I think you probably would agree with me if I were to say this. I mean, that you know, the meaning of Julius' words has been deliberately twisted.
Beyond recognition, beyond recognition.
Yeah, really. And I think that you already answered this to some extent, but maybe this is something that that we could build on a little bit. You know, the fact, you know, your paper focuses on that famous quote from Bishop Julius of Rome, quote, you know, "Are you ignorant that the custom has been for word to be written first to us and then for a just decision to be passed from this place," end quote. So, and again, I think some of this you've already covered, but maybe you want to add to it. You know, how has Rome twisted the meaning of this quote, and why is it important for Christians to understand what Julius really meant?
Yeah, so I'll cover that in two parts. First, we'll cover how Rome has twisted it, and then come back to why it's so important for Christians to understand what Julius really said, and in that way to resist the twisted history that is often presented by Roman Catholics to Protestants to try to get them to come home to Rome. The Roman Catholic Newman Ministry was formed in honor of Cardinal Newman, who was an Anglican minister in England, and he converted to Roman Catholicism and became joined the College of Cardinals. So history knows him now as John Henry Cardinal Newman. And the Roman Catholic Newman Ministry says that Julius's statement is, quote, "an early instance of the claims of primacy for the Bishop of Rome." So the argument they're making is, listen, everybody knows in the fourth century that the Bishop of Rome was in charge. And so history says so. So you have to convert back to Rome. And Ray Ryland, Father Ray Ryland, former Episcopal priest, he was speaking at a conference called Deep in History. And in fact, Cardinal Newman was the one who coined that term, that phrase, to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. And he claimed, Ray Ryland claimed, that Julius's statement proves universal Roman papal authority in the early church. And I wrote this paper because I believe Protestants should be very wary of such fanciful misrepresentations of what was said. Ironically, Cardinal Newman, like I said, coined that phrase, to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. And Ryland was speaking at a Deep in History conference by, you know, people who converted to Roman Catholicism. And in truth, neither the Newman ministry nor John Henry Cardinal Newman himself nor Father Ray Ryland were truly deep in history at all, because they fell for a fanciful reconstruction of what Julius actually said. their summaries, in fact, very, very shallow in history. I often playfully mock my the Roman Catholics who interact with me and say, you know, I don't think you're very deep in history here because you've missed this, 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 and this. And that frustrates them because the Cardinal Newman's phrase was supposed to be the gotcha point, the silver bullet that quiets the Protestants. To be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. The fact is, the people making those arguments are not very deep in history and don't want to be. If they wanted to be, they would have discovered exactly what Julius said and why he said it. So those historical misrepresentations are why Christians need to know this. It's just one of many falsehoods that Rome has fashioned into very, very effective weapons to bludgeon Protestants into submission and into conversion to Roman Catholicism. I mentioned at the in the paper that this is kind of the sequel to the previous paper called Nicaea and the Roman Precedent, which also it details a statement from the Council of Nicaea that has been twisted to make it look like the Bishop of Rome was in charge of everything back then. And again, to be deep in history is to go find out that that's not at all what that canon from the Council of Nicaea meant. So Julius's exchange with the Eusebian party took place in the mid-4th century, and Protestants say, oh, wow, I guess Roman primacy goes back a long way. So I guess we have to convert. And that's what happened to Newman. That's what happened to Taylor Marshall, who's an online YouTube personality. He used to be an Episcopal priest. It's what happened to Father Ray Ryland, a former Episcopal priest. It's what happened to Cardinal Newman. He thought he got deep in history, found something in the mid-4th century that sounded like Rome was in charge, and he dove in.
Now, it's interesting. You know, that's a great answer. So, I mean, you know, Rome has used a distorted interpretation of history to win arguments, to win people over, to win Protestants over to Rome. And of course, Rome is actively engaged in evangelizing Protestants. I mean, you see quite a bit of this. And, you know, I think that, you know, you mentioned Cardinal Newman, for example. There's actually a Catholic church that's pretty close to where I live that's named after him, Cardinal Newman, just a few miles from where I am. So,
yeah, in college, I was at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and, you know, typically college ministry is going to be called the Newman Club for that reason. It's a he's great inspiration to a lot of Roman Catholics, and he's basically a case study in conversion to Roman Catholicism. And so many attempts to convert Protestants are modeled after him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and you mentioned Taylor Marshall, and I know another gentleman. Now, I don't know that he's a Roman Catholic convert, but I'm thinking of Timothy Gordon, for example. I mean, these are people that have substantial presence online. You know, they have YouTube channels, they do videos very frequently, and they are, you know, in many cases, I mean, they're aiming their. And I don't know if everything that they do is designed as evangelizing Protestants, but I know that they certainly do a lot of that. And I know there are ministries that are aimed at doing that type of thing apart from them.
Well, Timothy Gordon is, he's what's called a revert because he was raised Roman Catholic, fell away from the church into, either atheism or agnosticism or whatever, and then returned to the church. So he considers himself a revert rather than a convert, but he makes a point. And this is relevant to what the question is that you asked, is he was talking about how he was speaking about the patriarchy and he was shouted down by some Roman Catholic feminists in up north when he visited, it must have been Notre Dame. And he said, you know, feminism has ruined Northern Catholic women. And so Catholic men need to move south, find a good Protestant and convert her. Because the Catholicism has ruined its women, and now they're coming for ours. Now, I say that in tongue in cheek, but that's actually what he said. He advised young Catholic men to move south, find a Protestant woman, and convert her. And you know what they're going to say? They're going to say, well, to be deep in history, it ceased to be Protestant, and Julius of Rome, early instance of papal primacy. So this is really, it's intended as to inoculate the Protestant against the arguments the Roman Catholic is going to make to their daughters.
That's a great point. I think I've heard you mention that quote before. Maybe it was in one of your other podcasts or something. So thank you for bringing that up. This is something that's going on. It's something, you know, that is the attempt to evangelize Protestants. And I think we as Protestants, we need to raise our game. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about the work that you have done in history. You know, you've gone back and you've looked at these things, and that's some of what we're going to be talking about here. So I think maybe with that as a kind of setting the table here for our discussion, why don't we get into your paper here a little bit? You know, after introducing the legal vocabulary of Constantine's judicial reforms, you focus on the history of three councils, Arles in 314 AD, Nicaea in 325, or I should say AD 325, and maybe that's the correct way to put it, and Sardica, AD 343. Why are those three councils so significant to your discussion on Julius' role in the trial of Athanasius?
Okay, so in the paper, I walk through those three councils, and Sardica is where we land, because Sardica is where Julius's own ruling was appealed and heard 3 years after his ruling on Athanasius. But the disputes that were present and being resolved at Arles and Nicaea were actually had fomented in 305 and 306 AD, before Constantine had actually come to power, and therefore before Constantine's judicial reforms had taken place. But by the time they're concluded, you find not only that the church has received and understood the judicial reforms, but has actually embraced them and canonized them. And that's what we find in particularly in Nicaea and Sardica, that the appellate process that Constantine initiated ends up getting canonized in the church councils and implemented in the church. So that's why those three councils are so important. And what Constantine did when he came to power, he was the emperor's court was the highest court of appeals, and everybody resorted to that highest court to solve everything, just minor municipal disputes and legal matters all ended up in Constantine's court. And so he actually implemented a reform that that ends up getting embraced by those councils. And he followed the advice. I'm not sure who gave it to him. I suspect it was Bishop Hosius, who presided at the Council of Sardica. But I think Bishop Hosius of Spain probably gave him some guidance here. And Constantine ended up doing something what Moses' father-in-law Jethro had prescribed. Because, you know, you remember Moses was overwhelmed. From morning to evening, everybody was lined up to bring their questions to Moses. And Jethro said, that's not right. You should set up a hierarchical appellate process so the small matters can be handled by the smaller courts, and every big matter will come to you. Every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they shall judge. That's Exodus. It's that whole account is Exodus 18, 13 to 26. So what you find and is that Constantine began to implement an appeals process. And so you begin to see the language of his appeals process folded into the vocabulary used by the church in its councils. And a few of those, that's why I start the paper by introducing the appellate vocabulary. Appellatio is Latin for appeal. Infamati is a term that means branded with infamy. An emperor could ruin somebody by branding them with infamy. And in fact, Julius, when he was talking with Athanasius's accusers, said that if they continued to resist his questions in discovery, that they were going to be branded with infamy. Instructio plena is Latin for full documentation. That meant that the entire process had to be documented. The witnesses, the litigants, the accused, the defense, they had to write everything down, and it had to be diligently copied and forwarded to the next court, so that when they got to the next court, the court had all the information they needed to make a ruling. In fact, we'll find with Sardica that they got the Instructio Plena from Julius and reviewed those books when they were considering the appeal. And this is a big one. This one's called Supplicare Causa pendente. It's Latin for pleading a case that is still pending. The whole point for judicial reform with Constantine was so he didn't have to hear every single case. They had to work their way up from below. And so it was illegal for someone to have a court case that is still being heard and then argue their case in other courts or to the emperor. It's illegal. Sepulcare causa pendente is illegal. You're not allowed to appeal a case or plead a case that's still pending. Potentiores is something near and dear to the heart of Constantine. He did not like the idea that powerful persons or potentiores could undermine his appellate hierarchy. He actually had some laws in place that any case that involved a potentiore should be forwarded to his attention because he didn't like it, didn't want it happening, and he tried to squash it. And then Episcopalis Audientia, this is a big one, Episcopalis Audientia, Episcopal Courts. After Constantine had implemented judicial reform and set up an appellate hierarchy, a hierarchy of appeals courts, he then conscripted the bishops to serve as appellate judges in a parallel ecclesial legal system. Litigants and episcopal judges were expected to abide by the same appellate procedures that govern the civil suits, which is why we find the appellate courts, the episcopal courts, adopting that same vocabulary. So under that rubric in which Constantine sets up an appellate process, and then he conscripts the bishops to serve as appellate judges, Christian litigants were allowed to transfer their cases from civil to episcopal courts, even without the consent of the opposing party. So if someone all the way up until the judge is giving a ruling and a sentence, they can say, no, I've decided I want this to be heard by a bishop instead of by a count in a civil court. So if any person should desire him to transfer his case to the jurisdiction of the Christian law, the bishop has to abide by, judge has to abide by that. And then the ruling of the bishop has to be held as sacred. By 333 AD. If a litigant wanted to choose the court of a bishop, both parties had to go do it, even if the other party was opposed to it. So this is something that's happening. In 318 AD, is Episcopal courts began to be put in place. By 333 AD, they have to abide by, if either litigant wants to go to an Episcopal court instead of a civil court, everybody has to just move on and do that without question. But what this did is it infused Christian bishops into Constantine's appellate process to decide civil and ecclesiastical matters. And that means introducing the appeals process into the church, which was entirely new up to that point. If you study the history of councils and disputes, there's no incidence of an actual appeal from one court or one council to another to hear a case again. Say, well, we don't like what that council said, so let's appeal to a higher court. It begins to happen when Constantine comes to power. And so we look back in history and we find one council says something, another council says something else, it gets appealed to a higher council. Until Constantine, the typical way of resolving these disputes was exchange of letters and opinions, and people would say, well, I disagree with that, here's my opinion. Well, we like that guy's opinion. Lots of letters went back and forth. What they didn't have was a formal appellate process. And what happens in these councils, you begin to see the church embrace the method of appeals that Constantine had prescribed. And we'll jump into the Council of Arles, because that was the first case, a significant case. Bishop Secundus of Tagissus had presided over the synod at Cirta in 305 AD. So this is the year before Constantine took power. And this is the Donatist controversy. There were some bishops who had compromised and betrayed the faith during the brutal persecution under Diocletian. And they got together. They kind of pardoned themselves. Secundus pardoned them all. And any further judgment was left to the hands of God. And so, but what happened was in what I consider to be just absolute hypocrisy of the worst form, those same bishops condemned Felix of Optunga on the same charges and then deposed the Bishop of Carthage who he had ordained. And so they ordained Majorinus in his place in 311 AD. Well, what what was to be done? There were two men claiming to be bishops of Carthage. Felix had ordained Caecilianus of Carthage, and then he was deposed and replaced with Majorinus. So they petitioned to Constantine. They didn't go to the Bishop of Rome and say, you need to resolve this matter. Now, what happened was Constantine assembled some bishops, and they met in Rome under Bishop Melchiades in 313 AD, and Caecilianus was exonerated. But the Donatists didn't like that, so they appealed again to Constantine. And again, they were requesting a civil trial, and again, Constantine summoned some bishops to handle the case. But notice that the appeal was not to the Bishop of Rome, it was to Constantine. Constantine then assembled some bishops, and the first hearing was in Rome under Bishop Melchiades, and then it was heard again in Arles. So basically, you could say that the bishop's ruling in 311 was heard again. I'm sorry, in 313 AD was heard again in Arles. So a Council of Arles is hearing a case that was heard by the Bishop of Rome just the previous year. So this is interesting to us because we begin to see a system of appeals be introduced into the church. And at first, when there's a dispute, they don't appeal to another bishop somewhere else. They appeal to Constantine, and Constantine pulls together some bishops, say, let's find out what's going on. So it provides a glimpse into a dispute that happened before Constantine took power, but was resolved when his system of appellate reform was being put in place. We begin to see the church embrace this. And what's interesting about this is that nobody had requested an episcopal trial because an episcopal trial had not been introduced yet. The episcopalis audientia, that is the use of episcopal bishops to hear appeals, had not been introduced by Constantine yet. That wasn't going to happen until 318 AD. And so this whole case is being heard under in a situation where appeals is new to the church, but they don't yet know about episcopal trials. It's Constantine that introduces that. It's not something that they ask for. What's funny about that is that when Augustine was writing about this controversy, he actually assumed at first that the Donatists, those who had ended up deposing Caecilianus, had requested an episcopal trial. And that wasn't true. They had not. They, in fact, had requested a civil trial, and it was Constantine that actually assembled the bishops. And Augustine later corrected that in his follow-on letters and acknowledged that, no, they had requested a civil trial. He was wrong to say that they had requested an episcopal trial. But here's the takeaway, and this is why it's so significant, is that the church is beginning to get its arms around this idea of an appellate system. And by the time Augustine was writing the history, it was so commonly understood, this concept of episcopal courts hearing cases under the emperor's system of appeals. He just couldn't imagine that that they had not taken advantage of that in the trial of Cirta and in Rome and in Arles. He just didn't understand why they had not summoned some bishops to hear it. Well, the fact was that they didn't do it back then. They had barely even begun to embrace appeals, much less episcopal trials. So that's what's fascinating to me, is you go back and find out even Augustine misunderstood what happened in this and then later had to correct it and say, oh, yeah, that's right. They did request a civil trial, not an episcopal trial. And that's very, very important to us, because in this period when the church is beginning to embrace appeals, the first time they start embracing appeals, it's appealing to the emperor to hear a case in a civil trial, not appealing to bishops to hear it in an ecclesiastical trial. And that's a very, very big deal. And Nicaea reinforces that for us. The Council of Nicaea is important for very similar reasons. While the Diocletianic persecution was still raging, Meletius of Lycopolis was convicted of many crimes and excommunicated by Peter of Alexandria at a council in 306 AD. And take note of that date. That's when the same year that Constantine came to power. So the system of appeals is not in place yet. So Meletius continued stirring up discord for many years afterward, and by the time the Arian heresy had arisen, Peter's successor Alexander was crossing swords with him in 324 AD, and Constantine attempted to extinguish that conflagration and implored them to be reconciled. That didn't work, and so Nicaea was convoked to resolve it. And it's important to understand that the Council of Nicaea in 325 is famous for resolving the Arian controversy, but less famous for what something else that happened. It was actually an appeal in which the case of Alexander versus, or Peter versus Meletius was heard, and a new sentence was issued, a reduced sentence. And that's very important to understand that the Council of Nicaea actually played a role in the appellate process of Constantine. So the what happened is not just that Meletius's case was reheard and his sentence reduced, his sentence of excommunication was reduced, but they also canonized some of Constantine's reforms in Canon 5. So Nicaea, in fact, had served as a court of appeals in the case of Peter of Alexandria versus Meletius of Lycopolis. And they say this in their synodal letter: the bishops of Nicaea reluctantly relaxed Meletius's sentence on appeal and tacitly acknowledged in Canon 5 that the schism could have been avoided through an orderly appellate process. This is the church recognizing that this is probably not a bad idea. And so they begin to incorporate Constantine's appellate process into the church and into the canon. So listen to the synodal letter that was written by the bishops of Nicaea. And it says, the synod then, being disposed to deal gently with Meletius, for in strict justice he deserved no leniency, but they decreed that he should remain in his own city, but have no other authority either to ordain or to administer affairs or to make appointments, and that he should not appear in the country or in any other city for this purpose, but should enjoy the bare title of his rank. Well, that's still a punishment. It's just not an excommunication. And that was, the sentence was reduced on appeal because the Council of Nicaea had been summoned not just to deal with the Arian heresy, but also to hear the case of Peter versus Meletius, and they reduced the sentence. So now listen to Canon 5 from the same council, which says, going forward, the church is going to have an orderly appeals process to deal with things like this, giving people an avenue to appeal adverse rulings. And remember, one of the things that they said about Peter versus Meletius was that Peter probably had been too harsh. And so it's basically canonizing this rule that says anybody who's excommunicated is entitled to another hearing just in case that their first one wasn't fair. This is Canon 5 from the Council of Nicaea. And listen to the fact that this is an appellate process, something that was foreign to the church being introduced canonically by the council. Concerning those, whether of the clergy or of the laity, who have been excommunicated in the several provinces, let the provision of the canon be observed by the bishops, which provides that persons cast out by some be not readmitted by others. Nevertheless, inquiry should be made whether they have been excommunicated through captiousness or contentiousness or any such like ungracious disposition in the bishop. And that this matter may have due investigation, it is decreed that in every province, synods shall be held twice a year, in order that when all the bishops of the province are assembled together, such questions may by them be thoroughly examined, so that those who have been confessedly offended against their bishop may be seen by all to be for just cause excommunicated, until it shall seem fit to a general meeting of the bishops to pronounce a milder sentence upon them. They're describing what they'd just done with Meletius versus Peter. They heard the case and they said, oh, excommunication maybe was a little harsh. Although he was a bad person, let's not do the full excommunication and just sentence him to provincial arrest, basically. He wasn't allowed to wander around doing his stuff, and he only kept his title. But he wasn't excommunicated. They reduced that sentence. So that's an appeals process. And this is a formal record of the church not only accepting episcopalis audientia, but also canonizing it into law. But most importantly to our discussion right now, this is the context in which Julius makes his statement. This establishes Constantine's appellate reforms as the context in which Julius exercises that Roman prerogative. And you have to understand it in that context. It was an appeals process, not the Supreme Court, and he was not the Chief Justice, which is why the Council of Sardica is so important to our understanding. Julius knew well, as he told the Eusebian party, that the ruling of one court is going to be heard in another. So you have to make sure that it's fair and lawful and complete, which is why Julius was asking them to provide evidence in discovery so that he could write down instructio plena, the full complement of all the testimony, and be able to document that so it could be forwarded to the Council of Sardica in 343, where it was heard again, and then finally to the emperor.
I like the way you put that. You talked about and I think it's a very easy thing to understand, you know, that Julius was not set up as the Chief Justice of the Empire. So he wasn't claiming that. That wasn't something that he was claiming. He had authority, but it was as an appellate judge, not as the Chief Justice. And I think that's a good way of maybe phrasing that. Helps me get a grasp on that. And I think that's helpful for the listeners as well.
Yeah, a bullet point for your conversation, your next conversation with the Roman Catholic. Julius was a frustrated mid-level appellate judge with an uncooperative plaintiff.
Yes.
That's what it was. That's all it was. Yeah. He's frustrated. And he's telling me, you know, you're supposed to be writing to us. And well, anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself.
but I think it's just a great point because, I mean, you can see how that history is abused. And it's frustrating, too. You know, you were citing, for instance, you cited the Catholic Encyclopedia, but you also cited Encyclopedia Britannica. And you might think, well, maybe they wouldn't be going along with that same line. But they do. It sounds like from what you said that, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica basically just repeats the same errors.
It regurgitates the Roman Catholic position, basically, and it's absolutely false. Mm-hmm. But that's why it's important. Is that to be deep in history is to cease to rely on Encyclopedia Britannica. And it's also to cease to rely on the Roman Catholic arguments of papal primacy in the early church. You know, whether it's Nicaea and the Roman precedent or Julius and the Roman prerogative and several other installments that I need to make, the historical evidence is that the Bishop of Rome had very limited jurisdiction in the early church. It was a small fish in an otherwise large pond. And you see that repeatedly, not only in Sardica, but in Nicaea, and the way other bishops interact with him for the first 300 years. He doesn't achieve what Roman Catholicism claims was an apostolic tradition of papal primacy until the late 4th century. But that's another story altogether. But it's important to be deep in history, and the Roman Catholic is not.
The Emperor Constantine's judicial reforms, they play a major role in your paper. And please, if you could, tell the listeners about his reforms and how they relate to the issue of the Roman prerogative.
Yeah, so this is really what it comes down to, is that what I've attempted to do is familiarize the listener with the appellate reforms, the church's embrace of them, the vocabulary that was used by Constantine and then adopted by the church to handle cases of litigation and cases of appeal. Now it's time to understand, well, what did Julius mean? He said, it's custom for you to write to us first so a just decision may proceed from this place, this church. So if you go into that with the assumption that Roman Catholicism is correct and has always, the Pope has always been in charge, you're going to read that and say, yep, see? It's true. The Bishop of Rome is the one, is the final court of appeals, which is absolutely not what he was saying. This is what's interesting about this. And if you go back and read Julius's letter and Athanasius's letters about his accusers, they had written repeatedly to Julius. There were multiple letters. In fact, by the time Julius actually says this, that it's custom for you to write to us first, he already had acknowledged two other letters that he'd received from them. So what is he saying now? Why would he say, hey, it's the custom is to write to us first so that a just decision may proceed from this place? Why would he say that if they'd already written to him first? Well, it comes back to Episcopalis Audientia, the episcopal courts that Constantine had put in place. And according to the law that Constantine had laid down, anybody who wanted to could have their court their case transferred from a civil court to an ecclesiastical court. And by 333 AD, anybody who wanted it, it was mandatory, even if the opposing party didn't agree with them. So this is something that happened a long time ago. By the time we're hearing this case, the fact that it's mandatory based on whichever party wants it, that's actually pretty recent. But the fact that there were Episcopal courts at all went all the way back almost to the beginning of Constantine's judicial reform. Well, what had happened? I mentioned before that there were basically five court cases involved here. There's Tyre, and then there's Antioch, and then it went, and at Antioch, Athanasius was deposed and replaced with Gregory from Cappadocia, and then it goes to Rome, where Julius hears it, it goes to Sardica, where Hosius hears it, and then it finally goes to the emperor's court. So it's five court cases, five different venues that this is being heard. What folks rarely know is that the first two councils were civil, the Council of Tyre and the Council of Antioch, where Athanasius was deposed. They were both civil trials. And the written record shows this. Julius says so. Athanasius says so. They said there was a count, that is a civil officer, who presided instead of a bishop. And the jury and the defendants were introduced to the court by soldiers instead of by deacons. They're complaining that those first two trials were civil trials. But remember, Athanasius has the option to transfer from a civil court to an episcopal court, and he exercises that right when he goes to Julius of Rome. And in fact, in the letters and in the written record, it states explicitly that when his accusers realized they would not have the advantage of a civil trial and that it was going to be heard in an episcopal court, they began to argue their case before the emperor and in other courts. So they violated two precepts. One, Episcopalis Audientius says that anybody at any time can transfer from a civil trial to an episcopal trial. And the second one, Supplicare Causa Pendente, they're not allowed to plead a case that's still pending. Julius was still collecting evidence and discovery, and when they realized that it was going to be an episcopal trial instead of a civil trial, they decided they're going to start arguing their case in other courts and to the emperor himself. That's what the written record showed. It says explicitly that they changed their approach when they realized it was no longer going to be a civil trial, but an episcopal trial. That's the context. That's the context. They had already written multiple times to Julius of Rome, but when they realized it was going to be an episcopal trial instead of a civil, they started violating Supplicare Causa Pendente, which meant they started appealing to the emperor while the current case was still pending. That's why Julius said, hey, you shouldn't be going over my head on this. I'm the one that's hearing the court case right now. You'll have your chance for appeal later. But for now, you have to write to the court of appeal, and that court is still in session. That's the issue. That's a really it's a remarkable historical fact that gets left out with Wikipedia, the Catholic Encyclopedia, Encyclopedia Britannica, that the first two cases in which Athanasius was deposed were civil trials, and Athanasius exercised his right under Constantine's reforms to switch to an episcopal trial. When that happened, his accusers stopped cooperating with the court and started pleading their case in other courts and to the emperor, violating the very precepts that Constantine had put in place to prevent the huge backlog that he was seeing in the superior court, the real superior court. So that's why it's so important for Christians to know the history and the context in which Julius says what he said. When you understand the history, you realize he wasn't saying at all that I'm the chief justice of the empire and this is the Supreme Court of the empire, or even of the church, because his own ruling was going to be heard in Sardica just a few years later.
You know, in your review of Constantine's reforms, as we've been talking about, and the historical survey of the period when the church, in your words, quote, the church initially resisted, then embraced, and finally canonized Constantine's reforms, end quote. You rely heavily on Bishop Julius' letter to Athanasius' accusers. But then in his conclusion, Bishop Julius seems to throw a bit of a monkey wrench into your argument, and you claim the custom, that of allowing the first appellate court to issue its decision before advancing to the next level of appeal, is of relatively recent origin under Constantine. But in his conclusion, Julius says that he is only saying what he had, quote, received from the blessed apostle Peter, end quote. So how do you answer the obvious Roman Catholic who would argue that writing first to Rome is actually a Petrine apostolic tradition?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I do cover this in the paper because I call it the last fleeting attempt by the Roman Catholic to prove primacy from Julius's statement. As he closed his letter to the Eusebians, having excoriated them for their violation of the custom, he also criticized their attempt to prosecute the matter independently and by the most violent and abusive means. And his entire letter there's a lot of legal argumentation in there, but some very, very pastoral. And in fact, he refers to various things that the apostles Peter and Paul have written and refers back to the Council of Nicaea, as we said before. And it's important to understand this about Julius and in the context of his whole letter. He says, he's criticizing how they've behaved. And he says, not so have the constitutions of Paul, not so have the traditions of the fathers directed. This is another form of procedure, a novel practice. Basically, he's criticizing. So I'm sidestepping his quote here a little bit for a second just to add these brackets. But he's criticizing what they've done. He's criticized how they've behaved. And he said, this is not what Paul said. This is not how the fathers have directed. This is another form of procedure entirely. It's a novel practice. Now, continuing with this quote, I beseech you, readily bear with me. What I write is for the common good, for what we have received from the blessed Apostle Peter, that I signify to you. Now, we talked about Ray Ryland. That's the end of the quote. We talked about Ray Ryland and him using this argument about Julius when he gave a speech at the Deep in History conference. And he said, see, this whole thing about writing first to Rome is something he received from Peter. Well, the problem is that that's a very, very shallow view of history that does not take Julius's own letter into account. You have to take, if you're going to quote a letter, that's the context in which the statement is made. And a cursory reading of Julius' letter reveals that he had invoked three authorities in succession, Paul, the fathers, and Peter. He said, not so have the constitutions of Paul, nor the traditions of the father. In fact, we're only asking you to do what the blessed apostle Peter signified. So, in fact, Julius had invoked the constitutions of Paul. He advised the Eusebians that they should not have let the sun go down on their vexation. That's a clear reference to Ephesians 4:26, do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Then he invoked the tradition of the fathers by referring to Nicaea for, quote, your refusal is not becoming, unquote, when the obligation to cooperate is of ancient standing and, quote, has been noticed and recommended by the Great Council. So there's the constitutions of Paul. He says, hey, you should not have let the sun go down on your wrath. You should have dealt with this as Christians. Second, you should be cooperating with this appellate process because the council said so. This is what noticed and recommended by the Great Council. But continuing, he said, what did Julius receive from the blessed Apostle Peter? And that he is now signifying to them. Well, he makes that clear in his next sentence. The problem is the Eusebians had been very, very violent in lording their authority over the sheep. And this is how Julius admonishes them. He says, the people have to grieve for those bishops who are forcibly taken from them while they are obliged to give over seeking the bishop whom they desire and receive those that they do not. So that kind of behavior, by the way, is contrary to what Peter himself had instructed bishops in 1 Peter 5:3 as being lords over God's heritage, but not being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. That's the issue. So, yes, he says, I'm advising you what I heard from the Apostle Peter. And then what does he say? You should not have been treating the sheep like this. That's a reference to 1 Peter 5:3. What's interesting about Julius is that he never provides citation. He never says, for example, by the way, you should not let the sun go down on your wrath, according to Ephesians 4:26. You should cooperate with appeals, according to Canon 5 of Nicaea, and you shouldn't be treating the sheep like this, as instructed by 1 Peter 5:3. Julius never does that. He never provides the citation. He just assumes that the person reading knows what he's talking about. And it's the same case here. He says the constitutions of Peter, constitution of Paul, the tradition of the fathers, and Peter himself disagree with what you're doing. You should not have let the sun go down on your wrath. You should have cooperated with Cana Phi and Nicaea, and you shouldn't be lording it over the flock. That's it. That's it. When he says, hey, I'm just telling you what Peter says. Yeah, he is. You shouldn't have been treating the sheep this way. And that's the sum. You know, Ray Ryland wrapped up his argument on Julius saying, hey, see, he's telling us himself. He got this from Peter. He didn't get it from Peter. Julius himself acknowledged that when Canon 5 codified the appellate process, it's something that was noticed by the church and accepted by them and adapted. It wasn't something that they had gotten from Peter. That appeals process came from Constantine. The admonition not to lord their authority over the sheep like they had, that's what came from Peter, not the appeals process, and certainly not the custom of writing first to Rome as a mid-level appellate court in an entire hierarchy of appellate courts. So that's I wanted to include that because that's the next place the Roman Catholic goes in the argument. Said, but he's saying he got this from Peter. No, he's not saying he got the appellate process from Peter. He's saying that bishops should not be lording their authority over the flock. That's what he got from Peter, and that's what he admonished the Eusebians.
Thank you for clarifying that. And, you know, and of course, that issue of lording it over the flock, that's one of the major problems of the Roman Catholic Church. They lord it over the flock exactly. As a church. You know, that is something that they have rejected as a church. You know, you as a Catholic layman don't have a whole lot of say, if any say at all, in what goes on. You know, you're told when they say, you know, when the Pope says jump, you know, your job is to say how high.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and maybe that's a little bit less now just because of some of the, you know, the Reformation and the like. And you know, maybe they have to come out and make some public appeals, but certainly back prior to the Reformation, you know, you didn't have discussions with the with the Pope for the most part. I think that's pretty accurate to say, or at all. Maybe that would even be more accurate. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's funny that that particular issue when they say, and this is another installment that I need to complete in the series, but you know, Clement of Rome wrote to the Corinthians to advise them when a couple of their bishops had been deposed unjustifiably. And Clement wrote back and he had some advice. He quoted the Proverbs on wisdom and those who reject wisdom. And then he said to the factious ones that had instigated this faction, they said, you should do whatever the majority commands. So do you know any Roman Catholic parishes where the majority gets to vote on ecclesiastical matters? No, that's just not that's just not how it works. And you know, when there were some bishops in Spain that had been deposed by their congregation, and those bishops went and appealed to Stephen of Rome, but the Spanish congregations wrote to Cyprian of Carthage and said, well, what should we do? And he said, do whatever you want. You have the authority to choose or dismiss your own bishops. That's not what they do in Roman Catholicism now, and it's a vast departure from the practice of the early church, where bishops were selected by the congregation. They were not imposed on them from other places. So it's funny, and the irony is quite severe. The irony you just pointed out is that they lord it over the flock by appointing bishops people don't want and taking away from them bishops that they do. And you hear Roman Catholics complain about that all the time now. You know, when you hear a predatory bishop just gets moved around to another location, they don't want him. The other people wish they could keep their previous bishop, and they're doing the very thing that Julius of Rome said Peter would have prohibited.
All right. Well, I wanted to move on to our next point here. I had a question for you about Constantine. Now, he's known in history as the first Christian emperor, and he does come off, I think, pretty well in your paper. He seems to have been a civil magistrate who was serious about seeing to it that justice was carried out in the empire. I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, do you think he was in fact a Christian, or is he simply someone who claimed to be a Christian?
Well, let's see. This is it's a hard one to sort out because I can't peer into his soul and understand where he was coming from. But we have to remember that what. It seemed to me that he lacked the wisdom and discretion when it came to matters of church and doctrine. And maybe I'm answering the question, taking the long route, but remember, it was Constantine that disagreed with Alexander's deposition of Arius. You know, he deposed him and excommunicated him. He didn't want that. He wanted them to be reconciled and wanted them to be anybody who wanted to join the church. Now, when the emperor is saying that anybody who wants to can get in, but the church is saying, no, it requires a credible profession of faith, you basically have an emperor claiming to be Christian, but working against what is actually healthy and right for the church. But Constantine did a lot of things that led up to what I consider to be a great falling away or apostasy as it manifested in Roman Catholicism. It was Constantine who, in his role as a Christian emperor, required that all funerals of the empire be performed by bishops and that bishops could charge money for it. He also began to take revenues from his treasury and dispense them to the churches for distribution to the poor and the widows, something that was supposed to be done by the people. The congregation was supposed to set aside food for the poor and take care of their own. And then he set up episcopal courts that basically got bishops involved in settling civil disputes as well as ecclesiastical disputes. That altogether, what can possibly go wrong when bishops begin to have civil power, and they basically are tied into the money train from the empire? They start making money on funerals. They start being the ones who distribute the money that comes from the emperor to be given to the poor, and they start settling legal matters in a court of law. Well, everything you can imagine could go wrong with that goes wrong. It was terrible, terrible ideas. The church was doing it out of deference to the emperor. They didn't like the idea of the bishops doing everybody's funerals, much less charging for them. In fact, they criticized some of the bishops for just making a killing on this, and charging exorbitant amounts for funerals and getting really, really wealthy. And then because the bishops were in the money line from the distribution of the welfare of the state, they would get lots of money, and basically the poor would line up at their doorstep to collect their food. And of course, that gave authority to the bishops over people that ultimately turned into a form of an urban militia where the bishop could command these people to go and do his bidding. And where did this end up leading? You know, you have funerals being paid for by the emperor, the bishops performing everybody's funerals, food for the poor is being distributed from the emperor through the bishops. You got bishops involved in episcopal courts. And finally, it led to what's called the Augustinian Consensus, where the church began to recognize that they had the authority to use corporal and capital punishment against the heretics. And what happens in a situation like that, where if you punish people for being heretics, corporal punishment, capital punishment, you end up keeping heretics inside the church instead of excommunicating them. Because if you excommunicate them and you could use corporal and capital punishment on them, they have an incentive to stay in instead of an opportunity to leave. That ends up poisoning the church, as far as the church in its shepherding role, the church in its role of preaching the gospel. Suddenly the church begins to look an awful lot like an empire instead of the bride of Christ. And so I can't blame all of that on Constantine. The fact that the empire was divided into 12 dioceses with a chief metropolis in each diocese, the church ended up aligning itself with that structure. And so whichever bishop was the bishop in the metropolitan city ended up having the most power over all the other bishops in his diocese. That extreme hierarchical shift in the church is not because of Constantine. That actually came from his predecessor, Diocletian. But you can see a steady path toward the church aligning itself with the world and its borders and its capitals, in its welfare system, in its judicial system. It's no shock that by the end of the fourth century, you've got a church that looks so much like the previous empire. The Roman Catholics today boast that they inherited the empire from Rome to fulfill a prophecy of Daniel. Well, I don't think that's I don't think that the church inherited the Roman Empire. I think the Roman Catholic Church fell away into apostasy and walked right into it with open arms. Again, your question was Constantine a Christian? I don't want to be the one to judge his soul. I can only say that he did not display wisdom and discretion in his interaction with the church, and he, along with Diocletian before him, paved the way that caused the church to fall over into a civil power rather than being the a church that was just passing through, not residence. Our citizenship was in heaven, not on earth.
So do you think it would be fair to say that Constantine, it's almost like he broke down that wall of separation between church and state?
He did. And what a mistake that was, because it's very difficult for, imagine what does money do to people? The love of money. Jesus says love of money is the root of all evil. And it put bishops and the church right in the direct line of the distribution of the emperor's wealth to the populace. And well, what happened is exactly what you'd expect to happen, is just sheer corruption.
All right. Well, that, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that, Tim. Maybe just as we're wrapping up here, and I know we've talked a little bit about points of application, but if there's something, maybe one or two points, what would you say are the most important takeaways, that our listeners could have?
The first point is that I would say the listeners should be prepared to hear the quip from Cardinal Newman: to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. It's important that the listener understand that that's a throwaway line that is actually a substitute for being deep in history. The Roman Catholic thinks that by saying that, they are alleviated from the responsibility to be deep in history. They have claimed to be deep in history, and that's good enough. Which is basically to be shallow in history. The second thing is that the statement of Julius had context, and it was a very specific context, and it's a very specific context that has been clouded in history and suppressed and ignored by the very people who are leveraging his statement. So the first thing is, one, the Catholic is not deeper in history than you are, and it's not hard for you to become deeper in history than the Roman Catholic. And two, it's good to ask, why is the Roman Catholic apologist so vested in suppressing the context in which Julius' statements are made? Those are two important points that need to be raised, and my intent with the paper was to equip the reader to be able to raise them.
Okay. All right. Super. Well, thank you for sharing that. And then it's finally, I know you've written extensively. I know a lot of your stuff has been published by the Trinity Foundation, but it's elsewhere as well. So if listeners would like to read more of your work or listen to more of your work, where can they find your work online?
Oh, several places. Obviously, the Trinity Review at thetrinityfoundation.org. They can find the not only Julius and the Roman Prerogative, but also Nicaea and the Roman Precedent. They can find that in the historical archives, in the review archives at Trinity Foundation. I have a blog at whitehorseblog.com, and I address all sorts of different takes on history and doctrine and eschatology there. Thorncrownministries.com is a place where I do some podcasts, and some of my work can be found there as well. And I have an active X account, formerly known as Twitter. It's at WHPUB. It's short for White Horse Publications. You can follow me there for quips and short interactions with Roman Catholics there. So lots of places to find me if you want. Probably the easiest thing for now regarding this paper is to download a PDF of it and take a dive, because you'll find that the Roman Catholic who makes the arguments about Julius and Roman primacy is actually quite shallow in history. And you'll find reading a few pages, it doesn't take very long to get deeper in history than the Roman Catholic is.
All right. Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time today, for sitting down with me and talking through this. I really appreciate that. And I'm sure our listeners do as well. So For my guest, Tim Kaufman, and for Trinity Foundation President Tom Judaitis, and everyone here at the Trinity Foundation, I want to say thank you to our listeners for joining us here today. And I also invite you to join me for the next episode of Trinity Foundation Radio. The Bible alone is the Word of God.
This is Tom Judaitis thanking you for listening to Trinity Foundation Radio. Please join host Steve Matthews next time for another episode of Trinity Foundation Radio. For more information about the Trinity Foundation, please visit our website at www.trinityfoundation.org. We have over 300 articles you can read, download, and/or print, and over 200 MP3 lectures that you can listen to, download, or you can also request CDs in the MP3 format. We also have over 65 books in print and other media which you can purchase from our website. Again, our website is www.trinityfoundation.org. And remember, the Bible alone is the Word of God. Thank you.